The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit, or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Religion and empire are often intertwined. Regarding Muslims, there are well-known dynasties like the Umayyad, the Abbasid, the Fatimid, the Ottoman, and many others. But the empire governing the largest Muslim population was, of course, the British. In Imperial Muslims, Islam, Community, and Authority in the Indian Ocean, 1839-1937, Scott Rees explores the social effects of the British Empire and its attending conditions on Muslims in the port city of Aden. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Aden was undergoing tremendous change, which was fostered by its valuable position within the empire. Muslims from both ends of the empire were making Aden their home. The diversity of the community and technological innovations shaped the everyday lives of Muslims. Rees explores Aden's sacred landscape by investigating how space was produced and organized. He demonstrates how unseen entities affected the activities that these spaces elicited. Questions of authority emerged through an exploration of local Islamic discourse, where authority was regularly asserted and contested across differing Muslim groups. The boundaries of religious practice were also being pushed through the practice of spirit possession. He also tackles the tension between the local and the global when the Muslims of Aden reflect on transnational scripturalists or Sufi movements. In our conversation, we discuss how local religious actors were shaped by broader Islamic trends, emerging print technologies, maritime flows, law and adjudication, the role of mosques and cemeteries, Salafism, and popular religious practices. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Now, my conversation with Scott Rees about his wonderful new book, Imperial Muslims, Islam, Community, and Authority in the Indian Ocean, 1839-1937, published with Edinburgh University Press.
Welcome, Scott. Thanks for joining us on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you?
Oh, I'm great, Christian. Thanks for having me on to talk about the book.
Yeah, so this really is a wonderful book, Imperial Muslims. You're doing a lot of work in terms of bringing different communities, different types of technologies together, looking at this very kind of interesting and dynamic community during a really important time in history. So I'm excited to get into this. We always start our interviews, though, with a little bit about the author. So can you tell us a little bit about moments or mentors that have been influential in shaping you as a scholar, kind of what brought you into Islamic studies? How did you become the scholar you are?
Yeah, it's funny. Actually, I often joke with my students when they ask that question. I say it was a whole series of poor life choices kind of brought me to this moment. I studied Arabic in college and then worked in Egypt as a third grade English teacher for a year, and eventually decided that I really couldn't do anything other than be a historian. But I also, after I'd had a lot of African history classes in university, and I didn't want to be just another U.S. historian who worked on Egypt or Syria. So when I started looking at graduate school, I really got fascinated by the notion of the Indian Ocean and the fact that you had so many Muslim communities, particularly in East Africa, who were very integrated into the larger community of believers and actually produced texts in a variety of languages, but mostly Arabic. And I realized nobody was really working on it. And so that's very much how I got drawn into it. And I ended up going to graduate school at UPenn and studying with Lee Casanelli, who was a Somali specialist, but who didn't read Arabic. And so as a result, I discovered that there was this whole library of material, mostly that had been produced in the 19th and early 20th centuries by Somalis, and but primarily in Arabic. And so I really started just following that trail and very much going down the rabbit hole, I think, in a lot of ways. And that ultimately led me to looking at history, not just from the perspective of a single place, but also looking at the interconnections. Because one thing I realized was that Somalis and other East Africans weren't limited to East Africa. In fact, and their worldview was much broader than that. And they had connections that led you in multiple and very often unexpected directions. So it's always been that sort of trans-regionality that's attracted to me. And it's something that it's been attractive to me. And it's something that my work has become increasingly focused on over the years.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, maybe you could tell us a little bit about how your work did develop and then how this project started to emerge, because this is, I think, your third book. And, you know, you kind of have different angles that seem to connect, but perhaps that has led to the Imperial Muslims book. So can you tell us a little bit about how all that came together?
Yeah, that's another, interesting story of serendipity. I was actually working on my second book, The Renewers of the Age, which is about Sufis in Somalia. And I was in London. I was supposed to be working with a traditional Somali scholar and working our way through this book called Majmu'ul Mubarakah, The Blessed Collection, which is by a relatively prominent local Somali Sufi. It's kind of on the B team, but the book was sort of influential for a lot of reasons. But as a result of one thing or another, we could never really connect with one another. And so I ended up with a lot of time on my hands. So I went to the British Library and to the India Office collection. And I thought I would look for things on Somalia, particularly from Aden, to see what if there was anything really to grab onto there that could be useful for the book. And in fact, there were a couple of things that I won't talk about now. But what I discovered in the Aden archives was this incredible nuanced treasure trove, the likes of which I'd never seen in an bureaucratic archival collection. There was certainly a lot of stuff about passports and Hajj traffic and bureaucratic things of that nature. But what I found in the Aden archives were these incredible stories of really the inhabitants of Aden. These were incredibly detailed, intimate accounts of people's lives as they intersected not only with the colonial state, but with one another. Because you would have petitions, you would have reports on local incidents, you would have with those biographical sketches of individuals, you would often have letters from people to the state. And these were all focused on the daily life of the community. And not only was this a rich source of material, but the other personal material and material that focused on the everyday. But the other thing that I began to quickly notice in the book was that almost always religion or faith was at the center of a lot of these conflicts or a lot of the issues that people were dealing with. And I very quickly realized that a communal life was really centered around these Muslim institutions. And so that's really how the book got started. And it was about a 10 or 12 year process of kind of taking that kernel of an idea and increasing incrementally pulling it apart to look at different kinds of institutions, including not only physical institutions like the Waqf or the Qadi's courts, but really going to towards the more ineffable, so that institutions centered around ideas like saint veneration or spirit possession. And so, yeah, it was a very long, drawn-out process, but one in which I became increasingly immersed. And I have to admit that this book was the most enjoyable piece I've ever written.
Well, it's a great book to read because you really do pull these kind of multiple threads together in very interesting ways. And I think the way you've framed it, this idea of Muslims in the imperial context helps us view this. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about what we need to know about the relationship between Muslims and empire to get into this project. How do things like power and community and technology shape the social lives of Muslims?
Well, I think there are two things there to keep in mind. Is as you say, the first thing is community, the other thing is empire. I think we have to keep in mind that the Muslims of Aden are drawn together from across the Indian Ocean littoral. When the British occupy Aden in 1839, it was a place that already had a very long history. In fact, it dates to the early Common Era. But by the 19th century, it had really fallen on very hard times, and it's essentially a big fishing village. There are about, at most, the estimates vary, but at most about 800 people living there. Once the British occupied the place in 1839, the population explodes, and it doubles within 6 months. It doubles again within a year. But I think what we have to keep in mind, what most people don't realize, is that this population that moves to Aden is not only drawn from across the British Imperium, but it's actually actively recruited. For various reasons. One is to provide kind of the auxiliary occupations that any port or military installation needs, dock workers, colliers, domestic servants, these sorts of things. But also they're actively recruiting merchants to come and settle there. Aden is always thought of as just a big coaling port that was occupied as part of imperial expansion, but as I demonstrate in the book, actually a very big part of British thinking in the occupation of Aden was the establishment of an outpost of the British East India Company that could oversee British commercial interests, especially Indian capital in the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea. So the thing is that you bring all of these strands of people together from across the Indian Ocean who create a single social fabric. But they're coming from East Africa, they're coming from Ethiopia, they're coming from India, particularly Western India, Gujarat. And one of the few things they have in common is being Muslim. And so this is what really begins to shape the basis of community very early on. The other thing that I think we have to keep in mind, and we often don't think of about the British Empire, is the extent to which non-Europeans are involved in the daily running of the state. And Aden, I think, is a very good example of this because there are only at any given time, you know, half a dozen European officials hanging around. And the vast majority of bureaucratic tasks actually to a quite high level in Aden are actually being overseen by non-Europeans, by Indians or Arab officials, who are really overseeing the daily running of the state. So things like the courts, police officers up to the level of inspector, the registration offices, a lot of the port offices are often overseen by non-Europeans. And most of these are Muslims, not all of them, but a very large proportion of them. And I think that these two things really provide us with a very nuanced understanding of empire and of community in this sense, is that Aden's Muslims have a lot of latitude in how they shape their community and how they develop it. So that, for instance, the emergence of the Waqf Committee, which I talk about in, I believe, chapter four of the book, is a committee that emerges among a certain set of notables to administer the pious endowments, which they argue had been allowed to deteriorate over time. The thing to keep in mind is that this is a wholly local initiative that's undertaken not only by members of the local ulama and other kind of important local notables, but actually Muslim members of the administration. The guy who's known as the registrar, who's a judge of small causes, they refer to it, sort of a small claims judge, is this guy named Khan. And he's a Bombay-trained lawyer. He's posted to Aden first as kind of an assistant resident, and then he moves into this judicial position. But he becomes involved in this committee in what is referred to as his private capacity. So that while the British ultimately recognize the existence of this committee and see it as certainly something that functions to the benefit of the state, it's something that's actually entirely the creation of the local population, of the local Muslim community. And so we see a great deal of agency there in how local society is administered and shaped over time.
Now, the real great part about the book is you bring both this kind of these kind of religious discourses and ideas about tradition, but then you also kind of give us a view from the ground of what people are doing. It's really great. I think you've done a really good job of kind of giving this great broad vantage point. And part of this is thinking about Aden's sacred landscape. So can you tell us how sacred space was produced and organized during this period? What types of places became important for Muslims? And what kind of activities did these places enable to happen?
It's a great question. Aden is as an enormously interesting sacred landscape that, very interestingly, is extremely diverse in how it emerges and has a function of providing sort of sacred venues for people not only in the present, but connecting them to a sense of their past or of a connection to Aden across the long Dari. So the really fascinating thing here is that, as I said before, most of Aden was very depopulated when the British show up in 1839. And in fact, the place is largely, there's a small stone town, but the place is largely a ruin. But if we read earlier histories of Aden, earlier accounts of Aden, there was a very, very vibrant religious and particularly scholarly life. And we have medieval accounts that talk about the proliferation of tombs and the presence of large numbers of awliya or saints. And what we find from the 1840s, essentially, is that as the Muslim community grows, we see the reemergence of sanctified spaces. When the British arrive, there are only two functioning mosques and two tombs. By 1850, this has grown to almost a dozen tombs alone, places where people regularly go to venerate individuals who are regarded as walis, as saints. And the interesting thing is, as I relate in the book, many of these tombs are actually ones that are revived, that are tombs that have certainly at least an early modern or medieval genealogy to them, but then are rebuilt and essentially reconsecrated to serve or to provide a focal point for the veneration of believers. And what we find here is that these very quickly become the sites of ziyarat, or annual festivals, that draw from a wide swath of the population, people from the interior, but also people from Aden itself, but also often people from the African coast will come for these ziyarat that are annual festivals. And there's a whole host of things that then begin to emerge out of that we can, and in terms of their significance for the community, but also, in fact, the imperial state. These become certainly a locus of local ritual and tradition. They also become very important economic events where the festivals center not only around the tomb, but usually in the much wider neighborhood where you have a carnival-like atmosphere and a lot of business is done at these annual events. But they also become, actually, oddly enough, a focus of the state, who actually begins to become actively involved in the spiritual life of the city. And this ranges from not only giving permission for these things to take place, but actually subsidizing them on occasion. And in the case of at least one resident in the 1920s, a guy named Bernard Riley, he actually participated regularly in the processions and took part in the laying of a new kiswa over many of the tombs each year, the cover that goes over the saint's tomb itself. So the state really becomes very invested in these things as an important social/spiritual event. But I think the other thing that, and I talk about this in the book extensively, is the role that these plays play not only in kind of a social/spiritual realm, but actually in terms of a window into, I think, people's more intimate spiritual lives that we often don't see, and is often hard to get a hold of, particularly in the modern era. And that these tombs are also seen as places where one can access the otherworldly, the external the dimensions that are external to our material one. And I think we see this in the sense in the fact that many of these tombs are actually reconsecrated. That there is, of course, a belief in Islamic theology that you have not only this life and the afterlife, but you have a whole host of alternative dimensions that can be accessed through something known as the Nur Muhammadiyah, the light of Muhammad. And effectively, the tombs are conduits to this because the saints themselves are connected to this divine light in a very manifest way. I don't want to say physical because it's actually metaphysical, but and that these are seen as places where you can gain, you yourself as a believer can gain a proximity to these things. We also see this not only in terms of access and going to the saint's tomb during Ziyarat, but the desire of people to be actually buried in proximity to these tombs very often. And again, this has a very long tradition in Islamic cosmology of proximity to blessed individuals with a great amount of barakah will ensure that one has a much more pleasant wait in the grave until the day of judgment. So you have this desire to be to be close to these conduits of divine light. And again, we see this in Aden as something that, again, binds the community together, I think, because this really transcends, geographic origin or ethnicity. And you see people of Indian origin wanting to be buried near the tomb of Sheikh Idrus, who's the big local saint. You see Somalis wanting to be buried near the tomb of Sheikh Uthman, who is a local Arab. So again, it's this desire to be connected, and this view that people are connected to one another as believers that again transcends things like ethnicity and language and the geographies of birth.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, you also come off the ground, so to speak, and then look at legal discourses and issues of authority and especially contesting authority. So, you've told us a little bit about kind of the professional and institutional context of Aden, but how did law operate there? Who was participating in these legal discourses and adjudication? And then how were these kind of boundaries or different authorities constructed and contested within this context?
Yeah, Aden's a really funny place within the empire because, it's administered from Bombay for most of its colonial history. It's only transferred to the colonial office in 1937. So as a result, it's actually for most of its time as an imperial outpost, it's governed by the Indian Penal Code, and it's supposed, but at the same time, it always remains this outlier where the Indian Penal Code never really seems to, and the structures of imperial law and legal mechanism never seem to be applied in the same way, in the exact same way that's being applied in much of India. Most relevant there is the fact that local religious judges, the Qadis, actually retain a great deal of authority right up until about World War I. Whereas in India, they've actually been, by this point, by the middle of the 19th century, been stripped of most of their authority and are really just kind of existed in an advisory registrar capacity, registering marriages and this sort of thing. But in Aden, they're not only still registering marriages, but they're overseeing divorces and also, but most importantly, overseeing matters of inheritance quite late. Really, as I said, until about 1910 or so. And what's particularly interesting about this is that this comes to an end and their power, their authority is restricted, not by European officialdom, not by some dictate of the state, but instead, as a result of the actions of the registrars, these judges of small causes, which is an office created about 1890 to relieve pressure on the court of the resident, and are supposed to deal with cases, civil cases, up to, I believe, 500 rupees in value. And right around 1900, you have two registrars who are appointed, one after the other, who are both Muslims. One is a locally born Adani, but from an Indian Sayyid family. And the other is this other guy, Khan, that I mentioned earlier, Yasin Khan, who was himself from Meerut in the United Provinces, educated in Bombay, and enters colonial service right at the end of World War I. And both of these guys want to not only curb the power of the Qadis, but accrue that power for themselves under the theory that, that on the one hand, they're a Muslim, and on the other hand, they're a lawyer. So that qualifies them to discourse on Islamic law, on Islamic jurisprudence. And so what happens is, over a series of years, they convince the state to restrict the power of the Qadis to the point where they are only overseeing the registration of marriage and divorce, and not only lose their ability to adjudicate inheritance, but also begin to experience greater and greater interference, especially in cases of divorce, but also questions of things, charges of facilitating underage marriages. Whenever there's a problem with a marriage that comes to the attention of the state, the registrars are very quick to jump in and use this as an excuse to point out the incompetency of the local judges, of the Qadis themselves. And over time, what we see, again, is to kind of make a long story short here, is on the one hand, the containment, the circumscribing of the power, the authority of Qadis themselves, and the growing authority and the growing influence in society of these largely civil functionaries in the religious life of society. Now, this isn't one that goes uncontested. In fact, the interactions between them can become quite vociferous between the two parties, especially over the 1920s. But what we see here is we begin to see the monopoly of the local ulama being eroded. And I think the thing to come back to here, the interesting thing is that this isn't at the behest of the imperial state. I mean, they're quite happy for the registrars to become more influential, but it's not an agenda they're pushing. It's an agenda that's being pushed by the functionaries themselves to assert themselves in what is seen as civil society. Effectively, the relationships, the functions, interactions of people in the community. And so we begin to see this sort of shift in authority, one that, as I said, doesn't go uncontested. but I think one that's very significant in terms of reimagining the public sphere in this period.
Now, you've described a little bit here and there about the kind of dynamic range of community members that are involved in Aiden. And in one chapter, you look at spirit possession and the boundaries of religious practice that are being kind of measured out in this context. So, you know, how did spirit possession operate in Aden? Where is this kind of religious practice coming from? Who's participating in it? And how is it perceived within the broader context, the broader Muslim community there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, the nice thing about the really interesting thing about spirit possession, like tomb visitation, is it really enables you to get to a different level of society, a kind of more visceral level of the community, where you're not just seeing the interactions of elites, but actually able to see, get a better view of the lives of non-elites, and particularly in the public sphere. There were two primary forms of spirit possession that functioned in Aden. Zar, which a lot of people are aware of. This is a spirit cult that has its immediate origins in Ethiopia. Its first recorded reference to it, I believe, is in the 17th century, but seems very closely related to something known as the Bori cult, which is a West African form of spirit possession. And this is a variety of spirit possession that we find throughout Eastern Africa, but also we find it in the Sudan, we find it in Egypt, we find it throughout the Red Sea, and even in parts of the Persian Gulf. We find it quite active Zar groups in Oman and Kuwait, for instance. And it tends to be associated, at least by the 19th century, it's associated primarily with servile communities or slaves. And it's also practiced primarily by women. And the idea of Zar is that individuals, women mostly, are possessed by particular jinn or spirits that have very particular personalities that take over an individual. And then the idea is that you don't necessarily expel the spirit. There's not really an exorcism that takes place, but there's a placation of the spirit that occurs. And there are various rituals that have to be undertaken to accomplish this, that include dances, that include certain invocations, but also include, most importantly, the provision of gifts. Things like perfume or incense or clothes that are things that will appease the spirit who's been making the afflicted individual ill. Now, as I said, we find this throughout Eastern Africa. There are accounts of it at the Royal Court of Zanzibar. Snoka Gronya talks about it. It has a very lengthy discussion of it in his early ethnography of Mecca from the 1880s. And as I said, we find a very vibrant scene in Aden and in Yemen more broadly. Now, there are two things here that we need to address. Is that one is whether or not this is something that resides within a larger Islamic discourse, and whether it's something that is permissible or forbidden. The interesting thing about the earliest references to Zar, the earliest accounts, is where it resides in relation to Muslim tradition, to Islamic discourse. And Janice Boddy writes about it in the Sudan. Has written a very influential ethnography from the 1990s called Wombs and Alien Spirits. And her experience talks about Tsar as something that's very closely connected to Sufism, and this is in the Sudan, mainly contemporary. She's talking about it in the 1980s, but also does some historical research tracing it back to the 1940s. What I found particularly interesting about the Aden case, and by looking at these earlier accounts from Zanzibar and from Mecca in the 19th century, was in fact that Tsar women didn't connect themselves closely to Islamic discourse, in particular to Sufism, to Islamic mysticism, but in fact presented themselves as something that was parallel to that, but not connected to it, that this was another spiritual function, another spiritual mechanism that women could avail themselves of that was not particularly Muslim. And it seems to reside in Aden expressly in that manner. They're not connected to the saints' tombs. They don't seem to have a lot of interaction with the local religious establishment. But at the same time, they're very much tolerated. This changes in the 1920s as we begin to get scripturalist reformers, what are sometimes referred to as Salafis, but those who look to only the earliest sources of religious discourse, the Quran, the Hadith of the Prophet, and the accounts of the Sahaba, the followers of the Prophet, as legitimate spiritual inspiration and sources of guidance. And they, of course, are very opposed to spirit possession. They see it as something demonic. And as a result, these women are ultimately pushed from the public sphere. In fact, they have to largely go underground, ultimately. And this is because they, in large part, one thing they don't do is they go out of their way, actually, ultimately, as you see in the book, to offend the religious establishment at one point. And this is interesting to juxtapose against the other form of spirit possession in the settlement, which is a much less well-known cult known as Tambura. That's actually pretty widely spread. It seems to originate, again, in the Sudan. It seems to be related to a spirit cult from the southern Sudan, associated primarily with the Zande, I think, and is actually primarily the purview of men. And the idea here is that men become possessed by particular spirits and then actually are healed from it, the spirit is expelled, and then they themselves can become priests. The interesting thing about Tambura, there are two very interesting things about it here before I go on and talk about the connection with Sufism, is that first of all, as I said, it's primarily men, but it's also primarily men from very low status backgrounds, either former slaves or other kinds of servile lineages. Like Tsar, we don't find it associated with particular ethnicities. Most of the men who belong to Tambura in Aden are, some are Sudanese, some are Ethiopian, and some are Somalis. And you find the same sort of diversity in Tsar, I should have mentioned earlier. But they all happen to be sweepers, garbage men in Aden. And again, they are very, very active through the 1920s. But again, they fall afoul of the scripturalist reformers, who also want to have them banned because they see this as a forbidden activity. Whereas Tsar is successfully banned and is forced underground, very quickly by the early mid-1920s, Tambura actually manages to survive. And they do this in two ways. One is that they're able to position themselves as not a religious activity, but as an entertainment, as simply a dance, something that the Tsar women try to do but are actually unsuccessful at. But they also have a much closer relationship to the to the local Sufi orders. And it seems that the local Sufi orders afford them a certain amount of protection with regard, especially to the state, where a number of Sufi functionaries, particularly those associated with the Idrus tomb, which is the big tomb in town, the biggest tomb in town, come back to the state and say, after their petitions to ban them, and say, no, these guys are really harmless, they're fine. And so it seems to be this relationship that they have with the tombs and with the local Sufi hierarchy that enables them to survive in an atmosphere of increasing scripturalist agitation through the 1920s and 30s. And this is something that the women, for whatever reason, don't avail themselves of. In fact, in a lot of their petitions and letters that you can read in the book, they actually go out of their way very often to offend the senior religious establishment. So they don't actively seek out that protection or those relationships for whatever reason. And my argument in the book is that, well, traditionally, Tsar is a parallel form of spirituality that didn't a priori share these connections with Sufism, with Islamic mysticism, and that these were things that had to be created. And the Tsar women in Aden decide not to do that. Now, in fact, Tsar does not disappear. It continues. It just has to get a lot less public. And so it persists at least into the 1960s in Aden. But again, it has a very different trajectory from Tambura. And I think a lot of that does come down to the choices that people make about how to survive in this changing atmosphere, one that's becoming much less tolerant of alternative forms of spirituality and interactions with the unseen.
Yeah. And that leads really well into the last complete chapter that you have in the book, which deals with kind of in an extended way this tension between authority and different types of reform and tradition. And one of the things that you do really well is show how this is locally shaped in a variety of ways. So can you explain this tension between kind of the local and the global? How would you say local religious actors are shaped by broader Islamic trends, and then how did the Aden community participate in the conversations that were happening globally?
Wow, you saved the most complicated for last. So, because this is really a huge question. This is really a large issue, and it's one of the places where I think the book best demonstrates that Aden, like most communities, is shaped both on the local level, but on the wider global and, in this case, imperial stage. A fact that becomes more and more omnipresent in the early 20th century due to innovations in technology, primarily steam and print. Aden had always been a very, was always a very ethnically diverse Muslim community. And what happens as we progress into the 20th century is that this place that had always been very connected to empire and with people constantly traveling between East Africa and Aden or Arabia and Western India, these connections become even more lush and rapid, and with the emergence of regularized steamship routes, but also print and the connection of Aden to the wider empire through reliable undersea telegraphic connections, cables. And what we begin to see with this is a lot of new influences into the local spiritual economy, particularly, as I mentioned before, ideas of scripturalist reform. And with this, we see not only a lot of new ideas emerging, but we also begin to see new actors. So people who are not members of the ulama, people who are not bureaucrats in the imperial state, although they still may be, but individuals like school teachers, local journalists. One guy in particular I talk a great deal about, Muhammad Ali Luqman, ethnically, the family certainly considered themselves Arabs, but they'd spent a long, many, many generations living in Gujarat. They were originally Ismailis, who by Muhammad Ali Luqman's generation had reverted, I guess you would say, to Sunnism. And they become very interested in these ideas of scriptural reform, largely from a moral perspective, looking at many of society's ills that emerge in the post-war period, in the interwar period, such as a fizzling economy and fewer and fewer economic and social opportunities. They look at these as having essentially moral causes, alcohol and drug abuse, profligate spending, a failure to save, the loss of feelings of filial and family responsibility. And so they're all looking for ways to rectify this. And for many of these guys, scripturalist reform, nascent Salafism, is very attractive initially. And people like Luqman establish a local chapter of a literary club. These are very, very popular in the Western Indian Ocean and places like Egypt in the interwar period. These literary societies that are formed that are places to discuss important ideas and to also become engaged in social service activities like basic education, providing relief during times of famine, assisting in public health matters when there are things like outbreaks of the plague, which happen actually kind of regularly in places like Aden. And you find these clubs, these kind of Islamic literary clubs cropping up throughout the empire, as I said, from Egypt to India and Southeast Asia. And this is just a local chapter of it. And initially, it's very, very informed by scripturalist ideology, this idea of only looking to the Quran and the Hadith as elements of religious and spiritual guidance, but more importantly, eliminating local unlawful innovations, or what of course is known as bid'ah. This included things like Vzar and Tambura, which are early targets of the scripturalists. These are but it also includes the Sufi tombs, the saints' tombs and Sufi veneration of them. But it also includes things like local rituals associated with prayer. So that, for instance, there's a local tradition of following the call to prayer, reciting two or three verses from the surah known as the Confederates in the Quran. And this is actually, you find this in a lot of places in the Western Indian Ocean, but this is determined to be by the local scripturalists as unlawful innovation and bid'ah. What's interesting, though, is that are two things. One is that a lot of the local community, while there's certainly the scriptural reformists gain a certain local constituency and quite a few local followers, there's a lot of pushback against them, particularly from the Sufi establishment. So that there are street scuffles between Salafi adherents and Sufis. There are disputes over whether or not you can hold zikr in particular mosques or not. And probably my favorite incident is actually at a local Salafi mosque where there's a prayer one evening. I believe it's the Maghrib prayer, and the adhan finishes and the imam begins prayer inside the mosque, and a bunch of guys show up on the portico, on the porch outside, and the mosque is too full for them to get in, so they don't go in, but they line up on the portico and they do the call to prayer again and then start the Maghrib prayer over again. And this is almost initiates a total throwdown between the two parties. And it's only the presence of a very quick-thinking policeman that diffuses the situation. But when questioned about why they had started the prayer after it had already begun inside the mosque, the leader says very innocently, "Well, you know, the verses from the Confederates hadn't been recited, so I thought there was no way the prayer had started, that the adhan must not have been given already." So he uses this to push back against these scripturalist notions that are very much at variance with what many in the local community see as an integral part of their own tradition. But again, there's a lot of pushback against the local ziyarat and local Sufi rituals. And in the early 30s, what happens is there are a number of scuffles that break out. There are a couple of fairly minor altercations, but the British authorities seek to crack down on them. And so this becomes a dispute that's fought out mostly in rival publications, where they both, and in fact, ultimately the scripturalists are forced to back down and seek some sort of middle ground, some sort of accommodation with the local Sufi establishment, which is actually at this point seems to be really kind of a majority of the population. And what we see is that this accommodation comes primarily from Muhammad Ali Luqman and others like him who are, because they are Nahdawi, they're individuals who see themselves as part of the Enlightenment, really want to see what they regard as progress, but aren't willing to abandon their own communal traditions willy-nilly. And what Luqman ultimately does is write a very eloquent statement about, he says this a number of different times, a number of different essays, but he says at one point, "There are those who say I am against the tombs, and this is simply not true. I love the saints as much as anyone. And that what we should really do is go to the tombs and use them as exemplars to meditate and to think on our own spiritual shortcomings and how we can be better Muslims, how we can be better people." But at the same time, eschew many of the less advisable elements of the ziyarat associated with the tombs. And what he's talking about are the festivals, and where there is a lot of gambling, there's a lot of alcohol consumption, people spend a lot of money buying new clothes, etc. And he says we should really tone that down. We need to, because that does go too far, and that's chewing away at our moral fiber and our economic well-being. And so that if we take the saints as exemplars, this is what's important. And so he really does have this huge role in reshaping the scripturalist discourse, which backs off from an absolute ban of saint visitation and seeks not even so much to modify, because the festivals never really go away, but to seek some sort of accommodation, some sort of middle ground that can be socially acceptable to most people.
Well, Scott, you really do a great job of bringing this kind of rich local detail to kind of illuminate larger questions that a lot of us are thinking about in Islamic studies. I definitely found a lot of parallels in my work in China that I was thinking about in terms of this conversation or dialogue between the local and the global. So thanks for writing a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, so I'm sure lots of people are expecting more from you. We don't want to.
Yeah, what have you done lately?
Yeah, exactly. So we're looking forward to more great work from you. So can you give us a little preview of things you might be working on or kind of have envisioned for the next project?
Well, right now I'm beginning to spin up a new project on the topic of print and publication, particularly in the interwar period. You know, a lot of what I work with are locally compiled Arabic sources, and we begin to see these working their way into print more and more frequently from the early 20th century. And what I'm really looking at are a number of things. First of all, I'm looking at the impact of print on a social and individual level, but also looking at it as having a kind of its just the technology itself as having a kind of agency, where technology, both print but also steam travel, have this enormous impact on not only are the ideas that people become exposed to during this period, but the interactions they begin to have, the networks that they function within, begin to shift and transform during this period. So I'm looking in particular at the emergence of a local print tradition, primarily in the Western Indian Ocean, East Africa, and Southern Arabia, and its interconnections primarily with the Mediterranean, because what you find is only a very, very small print industry emerging in East Africa and Southern Arabia. And instead, most things actually being published through Cairo, through one publisher in particular, a guy named Mustafa Halabi al-Babi company. It becomes this huge private publisher in Egypt that actually starts in about 1859, but becomes incredibly prominent by the 1920s, and in fact dominant in terms of the publication of books in the Western Indian Ocean, really from the Red Sea in East Africa all the way to Indonesia. And so I'm starting to look at is the relationships that emerge as a result of this press, and how does it become so dominant, and how does it impact the discourses and networks that people have been traditionally involved in, and how does it begin to shift those? At the same time, what I'm also looking at is how this works in reverse. How do these local authors begin to bring new elements of their tradition to a much wider print audience, which we see in terms of things like format and the use of certain kinds of poetry. And so, but as I said, it's a project and it's very early stages. So it's still pretty nebulous in that sense. So
we'll give you some time to work on it, Scott.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, good luck. And thanks for making time to talk about this wonderful book. I hope people will go out and get a copy.
Oh, thank you. And it is out in paperback now. So it's actually affordable.
That was my conversation with Scott Rees about his great new book, Imperial Muslims, Islam, Community, and Authority in the Indian Ocean, 1839 to 1937, published with Edinburgh University Press in 2017. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Please tune in to another episode soon.